This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, with episode number 851, 851. Thank you so much for joining me today as we dive into the best personal finance podcast out there. Yes, that is this one. You are listening to the right personal finance and investing and real estate podcast because it's the best one out there. People keep telling me that. So I might as well just repeat it to you. Anyway, thank you so much for your support and for joining me today as we interview Richard Duncan, a returning guest who was on the show a few years back. And this was a rather long interview. He was very interesting. We covered a lot of great stuff. So we cut this one into two parts because you know how my monologues go. I get on a tangent or two. The monologue is always so much longer than I think it is that we barely have time for the guest. But no, the guest will be here in a moment, and this will be a two-part interview with Richard Duncan as we dive into a whole bunch of things about the economy. And I got to say, as Richard and I were talking this time, I got to give him credit. He really moved the needle a bit. As you may know, if you're a regular listener, I am a fan of the Austrian School of Economics. I am a believer in, well, I guess philosophically, of course, I'm a fan of the Austrian school, but I'm also a pragmatist. And I think as ridiculous, as depressing as it is, we live in a Keynesian world where government and central banks just want to keep spending money. They want to keep spending us into oblivion. But, you know, many times during the failed Obama administration, yes, I am going to say it was a failed administration. And who knows, maybe the Trump administration will turn out as a failed administration too, because Trump acts like he's in high school. I mean, you know, what else can I say? The guy is just way too distracted with these little fights and wars and crazy stuff. He acts like the male counterpart of Blair on Gossip Girl. Anyway, so yeah, Trump, I mean, seriously, grow up, you know, Mr. President, you got to grow up a little bit. But overall, as you know, I think regardless of the personality of the man, I think he's going to be very good for real estate. He's going to be good for wage growth. He's going to be good for job creation. And overall, as much as you might hate him, if you're a leftist, I think he's actually going to be kind of good for the country. Not in every way, but in many ways. I think we're going to see jobs come back to the U.S. And yeah, I know, I get this whole thing about everybody thinks America has to, like, do everything for the world. And I think that's been kind of the focus in many ways for the past several decades. I think it's kind of nice to see that pendulum switch back toward do what's right for the U.S. for the change. You know, it's the old philosophy of, And you know, there's a million opinions and there's a million shades of gray on all this stuff. Of course, it's not simple. And I am not trying to make it simple. But the philosophy of the best way to help the poor is to not be one of them. You know, there's some merit to that. There's some merit to that. So the best way for America to help the world is for America to be strong. Okay. And, you know, so there's an argument. There's definitely some merit to that ideology. But also, you can't be a total isolationist either. This is not the time to be isolationist in the complex, interconnected world we have. So, you know, Trump represents the shift back toward that America first, isolationist type ideology. And as long as that pendulum doesn't swing too far, I think it probably should be swinging back in that direction. So love or hate the man, and listen, I got my reservations galore about him. Again, I think he needs to grow up, okay? I mean, these just stupid, silly, this drama, you know, this dumb, like, high school drama that he engages in, it's such a waste of time. And it doesn't do any good for the guy's image. So, look, I don't know. Whatever. Richard Duncan, super interesting. So the thing that Duncan did in this interview, at least with me, is he really moved the needle on my Austrian ideals. I think he's got a very thoughtful approach to this. So, you know, tell me what you think. I mean, give us some feedback on the show. We always love your feedback. And of course, we love getting you clients and listeners on the show once in a while. So if you want to come on and you got something interesting to say, you know, maybe it's not for an entire episode, but maybe it's just for the intro portion of the show, reach out to us. Go to jasonhartman.com. Reach out. Tell us what you have to say. And if you're interesting, you know, we'll put you on the show. If you're not interesting, hey, you know, we won't put you on the show. So, our listeners come first. That's who we've got to please. We've got to make the show interesting for them. Well, there's a Business Insider article out about a topic I've talked about many, many times over the years. And of course, what is that? That is about the disappearing middle class in America. You know, one of the things that has made the U.S. such a great country for so many years is the large middle class. If you want to be in a stable country, have a large middle class. Well, of course, for the past couple of decades, really, we have seen the concentration grow into the wealthy classes. So, interesting chart in this article. It shows that the top 10% of families own $51 trillion in wealth, or about 75% of total household wealth in the United States. Okay. So the way this breaks down is that in the bottom 50%, you've got a relatively small share of overall wealth. In the 51st to 90th percentiles, you've got a decent chunk in there, okay? That percentage is pretty big. They own a pretty big amount of wealth. But in the top 10%, a huge, huge concentration. And here's what's interesting about this graph. I wish you could see it. Occasionally, I love to have something visual, but audio is the best format, because it's portable. You're probably listening to me right now on the treadmill or in your car. A lot of you say I am the soundtrack for your workout. And if I can help make our gluttonous population that is riddled with too many diseases from a sedentary lifestyle more active, hey, that's great. Now, when I go to the gym and work out, I try to listen to some music, but, you know, I don't get to the gym often enough myself. What I do every day is I get on my little jump sport trampoline. I love that thing, by the way. And I do jumping jacks on it for about 3 minutes. On my Apple Watch, I just say set a timer for 3 minutes. I do some jumping jacks on the trampoline. And it's the JumpSmart brand trampoline. That is the best one, with the bungee cords, about $220. And just love that thing. If you get one, be very careful. You are not doing it under a low ceiling or under a ceiling fan. Yes, that's my disclaimer. I would hate to see any of our listeners, or not see, but hear about, any of our listeners get decapitated, because you might lose your head at some of the things I say on the show, but I don't want you to lose it from jumping on the trampoline under a ceiling fan. Okay. There's my attempt at really bad morbid humor. Okay. Anyway, moving on here. The top 10%, that concentration of wealth has become rather extreme since 1989. That's what this chart shows. And, you know, that's the whole point of what we're trying to do here, folks. We're trying to help you, our dear listeners, move into the upper middle class and maybe right into the very wealthy elite class of society, which is not easy to do, by the way, because as we just talked about, there's a lot of very rich people out there. But, you know, at least, and that's the thing, with everything Richard Duncan says in part one of his interview today, you've got to, where I'm a pragmatist, of course, as you may know, is align your interest and your investment philosophy with that interest and that philosophy of the people who run the world. Who are those people? Well, if you're conspiratorial, they're the Bilderberg Group. They're the secret societies, the other ones out there, Skull and Bones, etc., right? But forget about that. What we know, if we're not being conspiratorial for sure, is that they are governments and central banks. Governments and central banks, the most powerful forces the human race has ever known. And what do they want you to do? They want you to take out good long-term fixed-rate debt, and with that debt, control commodities, housing, namely, and the commodities that create housing, all those commodities, the ingredients of a house, right? And then finance them with long-term debt that you outsource the repayment of to somebody else, a tenant. This is part of my ultimate investing equation. Now, they won't tell you they want you to do this. They don't say this anywhere. We have to figure it out. We have to decode it because it's not clear, right? It's not clear, but you can see, and I have taught you over the years, that that is exactly what they want us to do because it's what they incentivize us to do through fiscal policy, through monetary policy, and through tax policy, which is, of course, part of fiscal policy, but not completely. It's only part of it. And so that's what we need to do. We need to align our interests with the most powerful forces the human race has ever known, governments and central banks. So last chance to come to our Oklahoma City property tour. I am sad to say, but hey, at least I'm honest, and not one of those hypesters that you'll hear on all those other shows and all the other websites surfing around the internet. Our Oklahoma City property tour and JHU live event did not, at least so far, did not sell out. So we have more room, and that is this weekend coming right up. It's summertime. Summertime events never do as well because people are on vacation and doing all that kind of stuff, and especially this week, because they are celebrating Independence Day, and many of you, because the 4th of July falls on a Tuesday, decided, heck, you got a four-day weekend, many of you, so you'll take an entire week off, and you're not coming to our event because of this. Well, hey, if you can make it, we've got Independence Day and then Financial Independence Day, which is what we'll be talking about at the Jason Hartman University Live and Oklahoma City Property Tour this weekend. Go to jasonhartman.com and join us for that. And also the Venture Alliance, our next event, already starting to plan it. It will be in Palm Springs, California, or at least the Palm Springs area. It's not totally planned yet. And then after that, we're planning on Key West, Florida and Cuba. Yes, Cuba, very exotic. Going back in time to 1959. Yes, I was in Cuba about 12 years ago, and it is fascinating. It's like stepping into a time machine. Who says time machines don't exist? All you need to do is go to a communist country, and then you can basically go back in time, because when communism starts, pretty much everything stops. Okay, so yeah. Key West and Cuba as a joint trip, and we are planning that one too. So check out the Venture Alliance at VentureAllianceMastermind.com or, of course, on JasonHartman.com. And let's get to part one of Richard Duncan. I think you will find this interview to be quite fascinating. And then we'll have part two on the next episode. Here we go. It's my pleasure to welcome back a returning guest, and that is Mr. Richard Duncan, coming to us from Thailand, from Bangkok. He is publisher of Macro Watch. He's a former economist at the World Bank and the IMF. He is chief economist at Black Horse Asset Management and author of The New Depression, The Breakdown of the Paper Money Economy, and The Dollar Crisis, Causes, Consequences, Cures. Richard, welcome back. How are you?
Jason, thank you. Very well, thanks. Nice to be back.
Tell us what's going on in Bangkok, Thailand, before we dive in. What's the weather like? Probably tropical and just beautiful always, right?
Yes, it's always nice, almost always sunny here. Very nice weather, very nice people, very nice food. It's a great place to live.
Yeah. Well, you know, how long have you lived there?
I've lived in Asia for almost 30 years, moving around between Hong Kong, Singapore, and Thailand. So I've lived in Thailand twice for a total of 14, almost 15 years now.
Yeah, fantastic. And did you, when you worked for the World Bank and the IMF, were you in Hong Kong maybe, or where were you located?
Well, so with the World Bank, I was based in Washington. I had been living in Asia for quite a long time before then. And when the Asia crisis happened, I had been anticipating a crisis in Thailand for quite a long time. I'd been the head of the office for James Capel Securities, and then later a head of research here for Salomon Brothers. And I'd watched Thailand blow into an enormous economic bubble in the first half of the 1990s. And it didn't pop until 97. But then when it did pop, of course, the economy contracted by 10% in 98. And the Thai stock market fell 95% in dollar terms. So wow. At that point, I started calling up the U.S. Treasury Department and the IMF and the World Bank, trying to get one of them to hire me. And first, the IMF hired me for a consulting job for 3 weeks, and I went to Bangkok with them in May of 98 and tried to show them what was happening here, because they really didn't have a very good idea. But I'd been here for 6 years with a team full of analysts analyzing the economy. So that was interesting. And then after that, I joined the World Bank in Washington later in 98 and worked for them for a couple of years there before coming back to Asia.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you've been inside in the belly of the beast, so to speak, and you don't have a lot of faith in the fiat money system, it sounds like. So would you be considered a rebel at the IMF and the World Bank?
Well, I'm not really sure what they would think of me at this stage, but I view myself as a realist. I think my view is rather unique in that, yes, I understand that it was an explosion of fiat money and credit creation that led to this crisis of 2008. In fact, that's what my first book forecast very clearly, The Dollar Crisis. That was the theme of that book, published in 2003. So, but also, rather than predicting imminent doom and gloom, I think we need to understand how this system works now, because it works entirely differently than it did back when we were on a gold-backed monetary system. Everything has completely changed. And in fact, you can trace all of this evolution of our economic system really all the way back to World War I, because that's the first time the gold standard broke down. And during World War I, all of the European nations went to war with each other. They didn't have enough gold to fight the war, so they started issuing enormous amounts of paper money to finance enormous amounts of government bonds. And all of the credit created during World War I led to the Roaring Twenties. That's why we had a global credit bubble. And that credit bubble blew up in 1930 when the credit couldn't be repaid. And at that time, the policymakers really didn't know what to do, and they didn't do much of anything. And the global economy, the global credit bubble completely imploded. We had a 10-year depression, and it didn't end until World War II started. Well, at that point, then government spending in the U.S. increased by 900%, an extraordinary surge. And the government took over complete control of the economy. They took over production, distribution, prices, and labor. They controlled everything. And afterwards, we never returned to anything resembling capitalism. since that time, we've had an economy that's managed at the macro level by the government. So it's crucial for individuals as investors to understand that the government is managing the economy. And it's crucial for them to understand how it's being managed and what drives the economy and what the government is going to do next to make sure that the economy continues to grow. So that's what I focus on now in my work with MacroWatch, my video newsletter.
Right, right. Would it be fair to say then that you are not a Keynesian?
We need to be open-minded. There have been many very brilliant economists over the last couple of centuries, and some of the work applies at some times, and some of the work is more appropriate, their policy recommendations are more appropriate at other times. We need to pick and choose depending on our current situation, which keeps evolving.
Okay, so fair enough. That's a very good answer. So what is Richard Duncan now? What do you think we should do? And I'm going to take this back to our last interview because I remember something you said that struck me. I'm pretty sure it was you. But go ahead. Where do you think we are now? Like, what's the right thing to do at this time in history?
Okay, well, so to begin with, it's important to understand now that it's credit growth that drives economic growth.
Right.
And any time credit in the United States grows by less than 2%, adjusted for inflation, mm-hmm. then the U.S. goes into recession.
Okay, and where is that now? Tell us about that now. Where are we now?
Yeah, well, last year it was 2.7%.
Okay.
But I project this out. There are only five or six major sectors of the economy to look at in terms of their size and significance for credit growth in the country. The government, the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the household sector, the corporate sector.
Sally Mae.
Yeah. Right. So you can project these out or you can make guesses about how much they're going to grow by. And it looks like we're at this year just going to hit 2% and next year even less. So credit growth is not rapid enough to drive economic growth.
Right. But is that credit growth in like the total dollars of all kinds of credit or, you know, how do you measure
yes.
that? Because, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, total credit is equal to total debt, the two sides of the same coin. So you can think about this as all the debt in the country, the government debt, the household sector debt, the corporate debt, the financial sector debt, all the debt. And someone has to take on more debt to make credit grow. And so it's in the past, people used to think that it was important to monitor the growth in the money supply. But in our world, there's no difference between money and credit any longer.
I couldn't agree more. You know, Richard, I tell you, during the Great Recession, it just blew my mind that I would watch all these idiot talking heads on CNBC, and they would be talking about, well, the money supply this and the money supply that, and, you know, conveniently they stopped counting M3, you know, right about then, you know, which I'm sure you'll recall. But regardless of that, it's not the money supply, it's the credit supply. Credit had dried up in so many assets in our, you know, 72% consumer economy in the U.S. are based on credit. They're credit-based assets. And that's why in the cyclical real estate markets, it stung so bad because, you know, housing is based on credit. And, well, so's everything else pretty much for that matter. You know, so, I mean, I just couldn't believe it. It was like no one was talking about the credit supply. You probably were. But by and large, I it was like the elephant in the room. I would listen to these interviews one after another after another. And they were all talking about the money supply. Now, maybe they meant credit supply included in that, but they never said it.
Well, that's right. I mean, in the past, there was a difference between money and credit. Money was gold, and credit yeah. was a promise to repay gold. But now, right. Dollars are no longer backed by gold. And yeah. so a dollar is essentially a credit instrument now. It's just the government will give you another dollar. If you take them a dollar, they'll give you another dollar. So now...
Fair enough. But I think you probably... I mean, I don't know. Do you? It seems like you need to make a distinction between that type of credit, which has, you know, Federal Reserve note, and credit of number of mortgages, student loans, credit cards, auto loans. I mean, there is a difference in those two, right?
Well, right. In fact, the physical money itself is just a very small subset of total credit. Total credit is something like $66 trillion now in the U.S., total debt, whereas the money actually in circulation would be less than $2 trillion. So the money is completely irrelevant. What matters is the credit. And what And so it's through credit growth that we get economic growth. And also important is asset price inflation. So since the government has been managing the economy by pushing down interest rates and through quantitative easing, pushing up asset prices. And so interest rates are really the key to what's going to happen in our future. They're now very near rock bottom levels, but if interest rates move higher, then credit growth will contract and the economy will go into severe recession. And also, if interest rates go higher, then asset prices like property prices and stock prices will also move down, and there'll be a negative wealth effect. And that also would cause the U.S. to go into severe recession. So we would be looking at a double yep. crisis.
So as I have been saying for easily 14 years now, this whole thing is it's a house of cards. It's a game of smoke and mirrors. The wealth is not real. It is, I mean, some of it is, there is some base real wealth, but most of it is just a sham. Like, you know, America has been living off this in this sort of fake prosperity bubble for four decades, or, you know, easily, right? Four and a half decades. It's ridiculous, right? The whole thing, you just got to keep it going, keep feeding the credit machine and getting lenders to lend. And heck, if they won't lend, well, just push interest rates down really, really low. And then if that doesn't work, start buying the bonds and putting them on the Fed's balance sheet.
Right? Well, yes. I mean, it certainly doesn't resemble capitalism. This I call this system creditism, because it's not driven by capital accumulation, as capitalism was. It's driven by credit growth. And this system, I really think you can trace it back. The government has been managing the economy now for something like 76 or 77 years since World War II started. So the trick is just to understand how they do it. And also, I believe that they can continue doing this for a very long time, with unless they do something really stupid, which of course can never be ruled out.
Of course not. And you keep saying the government is managing the economy, and I want to make like air quotes, you know, with that almost should be said in a snarky way, because managing is a joke. Give us some sense of how much, I mean, in your MacroWatch website, you have a great video on the front page, and it shows the credit growth from 1968. And it's just, this is, a lot of this wealth is just fake, right?
Well, so if I may, let me mention, your listeners can find my website if they type in richardduncaneconomics.com. And that's, they can sign up for my free blog. Or if they'd like to subscribe to MacroWatch itself, the video newsletter, they can with a 50% discount if they use the discount coupon code GLOBAL. So please keep that in mind.
Okay, good. So the question is, though, so you're going to answer the question about how much credit growth, but the issue here is everybody that keeps predicting the end of the world keeps being wrong. And I think back to, you know, Howard Ruff in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s. He kept saying that and it never happened, right? And the question is, how long can you keep the game going? If you can keep credit expansion going, then everything's fine. But eventually, and I don't know, is it next year? Is it 10 years from now? Is it 100 years from now? Is it 300 years from now? Nobody knows the answer to that. I mean, I get all these newsletters all the time, Richard, and they say, well, you know, the end of the world's going to be in August 2017. And then before that, you know, it said the end of the world was going to be, you know, last year in September. And it's like, who do you really believe here?
Well, the end of the world almost was 2008. If the policymakers had responded in 2008 in the same way that they did in 1930, then we probably wouldn't be having this conversation right now. The global economy would have collapsed, and we might well be in World War III. It would have been a complete economic catastrophe. But instead, they responded completely differently.
So you were in favor of their response, it sounds like, because I was kind of the opinion, you know, we got to just take our tough medicine. It'll be really bad for 2 years, and then it'll be better. We'll come out of it better. You know, let the market fix itself rather than all the bailouts and the money printing. But it sounds like you disagree with that.
Well, I disagree with it now. I really very accurately predicted what was going to happen in the crisis of 2008 and the policy response. to it. I can't claim to have realized how well the policy response was actually going to work. For one thing, no one was quite sure about quantitative easing at that point. We hadn't seen anything like that before, although Ben Bernanke had told us that's what he would do when the crisis struck.
He did bring that helicopter, didn't he?
That's right. And actually, it worked very well in retrospect. They had three rounds of quantitative easing. They created $3.5 trillion from thin air and used it to buy bonds. And that not only drove up the bond prices and drove down the bond yields, but it forced the people who own those bonds to buy other financial assets like stocks. So that pushed up the stock market very sharply. So total household net worth has increased by something like $40 trillion since 2009. That's up something like 70% almost since 2009 because of quantitative easing. Now, my fear was that quantitative easing would cause inflation, and in particular, that it would cause commodity price inflation. And for a while, that looked like that's what was happening. We had very high food price inflation back in 2010 and 11, and that caused the Arab Spring. But the next year, the farmers planted more and food prices came back down. And so what we've seen is that this combination of a very large increase in U.S. government debt, the government has almost doubled its debt since 2008. It's issued another something like $10 trillion of government debt. And a third of that has been financed by paper money printing. And that government debt, that spending stimulated the economy directly through fiscal stimulus, and in combination with this very aggressive and unorthodox monetary policy of massive money creation that kept interest rates low. The low interest rates stimulated the economy by allowing borrowing to be cheaper and pushing up asset prices. And in combination, it reflated the bubble so we didn't collapse into a 1930s-style depression. Now, the question is how long can this continue? Well, with the right policies, it could continue for a very long time, I believe. For instance, look at Japan. Japan's crisis, their bubble popped in 1990, 27 years ago. And since then, they've taken Japanese government debt as a percent of GDP from 60% of GDP up to 250% of GDP. And by doing that, they have kept their bubble inflated. They have not had a depression. And they have financed an enormous amount of this through paper money creation on a very aggressive scale. In fact, Japan is still printing money very aggressively now. And has this caused inflation in Japan? No, they have no inflation, and interest rates are near zero. So U.S. U.S. government debt is only 110% of GDP.
Only, yeah. Yeah,
so the U.S. economy is $19 trillion in size. That suggests the U.S. government could have another $19 billion of deficit spending, say, over the next 10 years before it even hit 200% government debt to GDP. And that assumes 0% GDP growth. So if they spent that kind of money, the economy would grow by 10% every year, and we would never hit 200% government debt to GDP. So this could go on for a very long time, as long as there's no inflation.
Okay, so you're saying if they keep the same policies going, we could be okay. This sort of ridiculousness can continue for a long time.
Well, look, the crisis now was almost 9 years ago. Through these policies, this has been going on for 9 years. There's nothing on the horizon that suggests that our economy is about to collapse any moment, or for that matter, that the Japanese economy is about to collapse any moment. So if they continue with these policies, then yes, this could go on for a very long time. In fact, perhaps long enough for us to grow our way out of this crisis, find a permanent solution. But that's a completely different story. Most people are more interested in what's going to happen in the near term in terms of their own wealth. And so the importance there is to understand what steps the policymakers are going to take on an incremental basis and how that's going to affect things. And right now we're at a very sensitive moment because the Fed has begun talking about reversing quantitative easing. In other words, instead of printing money and buying assets, they're now talking about selling part of the $3.5 trillion worth of assets that they already bought it's the opposite of quantitative easing. In other words, it would be quantitative tightening.
Yeah, yeah, they're trying to reverse what they did during the Great Recession. So that concerns you, right?
That concerns me, yes, because if they do, then that could cause interest rates to rise. In other words, the Fed bought up $3.5 trillion worth of bonds, mostly government bonds, but also bonds backed by Fannie and Freddie. Now, if it begins to sell those bonds, it is going to take money. It will sell the bonds to someone. Whoever buys the bonds, they have to pay the Fed. So that takes money out of the economy. It reduces the amount of liquidity in the economy. It reduces the amount of money that could go into the stock market or into the property market, or for that matter, into the bond market. So it will make interest rates go up.
But look at what happens to all the older people that want to just put their money in a CD. I mean, the higher interest rates definitely benefit some people. I mean, lots of people hate these low interest rates, right?
Yes, but they would hate it even more if the stock market fell by 50% and the property market fell by 50% and unemployment went up to 10% again. So that's a real danger. This is a real threat to interest rates, because interest rates truly are the key to what happens next. I mean, if we look back to, let's say, back to 1980, at that time, we had still had the high inflation from the 1970s, and the interest rates, the 10-year government bond yield, was 15% in 1981. And since that time, interest rates have become lower and lower now, until the point now where the 10-year bond yield is only about 2.3%. Well, during that time, as interest rates became lower, then credit became more affordable. So the Americans could afford to borrow more, and borrow more they did. And so the ratio of total debt to GDP in the U.S. moved up from something like 150% in 1980. Now it's 360%.
That's just shocking when you hear numbers like that. But the question is, how high could it go? Maybe it can go to 17,000%, right?
Well, it depends on the interest rate, because it was only able to go higher because the low interest rates made credit more affordable. But if interest rates now begin to move higher for whatever reason, quantitative tightening, for instance, then credit's going to start to contract. And not only will we not have 2% credit growth, we will have a contraction in credit growth. And when credit begins to contract, then the crisis would begin again. We would go back into severe recession.
Right. But there's always an offsetting effect, right? Or not always, I guess, but there could be an offsetting effect. So we could have inflation. We could see wage growth. We could see, I mean, listen, you know, all of my life, you know, I've lived in higher interest rate environments. In fact, sometimes much higher, you know, in the Jimmy Carter hangover. So this is the anomaly. It's not, you know, I mean, the anomaly is now. It's these past 10 years of these very low rates. To me, this is not normal at all. It's artificial.
Well, it's a completely new development. It's because of globalization. The reason that everything has changed is because when we were back on a gold standard, or even the Bretton Woods system, that required that trade between countries had to balance, because when we were on the gold standard, we couldn't have big trade deficits with any other country, because those deficits had to be paid for with gold, and a country would very quickly run out of gold if it had a large trade deficit.
Yeah, now we can just pay them with depreciating dollars. That's so fun. What a deal for us, right?
That's right. So now, back then, we just had a relatively small domestic closed economy. And if the government spent too much money or printed too much money, that domestic economy quickly hit domestic bottlenecks in industrial capacity and in labor. So inflation would pick up, and then interest rates would go up. But everything changed in 1980 after Bretton Woods broke down. The U.S. started running massive trade deficits starting in the early 80s. And so we circumvented those domestic bottlenecks. We now have a massive global economy with infinite capacity in labor and industrial capacity. And ever since then, we've seen extreme downward pressure on wages and disinflation verging on deflation. And that's why interest rates have calmed down, because there's so much disinflationary pressures from globalization. And that's why we've gotten away with all the
right, but wait till the robotics movement really hits. I mean, you know, we haven't even seen that really hit yet. Wait till that happens. Won't we just have more of what we're having now?
That would mean more deflation and possibly lower interest rates.
Right, but your concern is higher interest rates. So if we have lower interest rates, then we have more expansion of credit, and we just have the same, you know, the punch bowl just gets bigger, and the, you know, they keep putting more booze in it, and everybody's just partying, right? You know, so I don't know. It's, this stuff's so complicated.
And you do have to think about it in terms of, you know, what's going to happen, in what sequence will things happen in, and what will be the intermediate impact, not just the long-term consequences of, you know, that may be a factor, a much more important factor 10 years from now. But right now, what we need to worry about is quantitative tightening. If the Fed starts selling off its bonds and we get a spike in interest rates, then it could be quite bad for the overinflated stock market and property market.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guests' opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice, or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.